This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
So I'd like to ask you this morning to just contemplate on why you're here. Consider what brought you to this practice, or why you think it might be bringing it to you. What do you expect from it? So I think there can be a lot of confusion in practice around that very question. Why is it that you think you're here? What are you looking for from it? Are you looking for an experience? Are you looking for an enlightening experience? The Buddha was very clear in what he taught. He taught that there is suffering, that there are causes of suffering, and that there's a way free of the suffering. In my experience, if you're looking for the experience, you're not too interested in suffering. A lot gets passed over, a lot gets repressed and pushed aside. The Buddha, he did that. The first two teachers he worked with, that's what he realized. It came to him fairly easily. And then he figured out, well, I'm back where I started. Still with the suffering. Sometimes, when we talk about suffering in these talks, we talk about, well, not really suffering, but, you know, dis-ease, dissatisfaction. The Buddha did talk about, you know, the wobbly wheel. So like when your car, you know, one of your tires is out of balance, or out of alignment, and what happens, something feels off. But for me, it's suffering. These other aspects, the offness, something feeling out of balance, it's on the spectrum of suffering. And so when he looked into the nature of suffering, he had these insights. One is he saw the conditioned nature of all things. All things are dependent. He said, this existing, that exists. This arising, that arises. This not existing, that no longer exists. This ceasing, that ceases. Dependent arising. That's it. That's the nature of reality. And he also saw that there is this deeply ingrained something in us. He said, by and large, Kachana, this world relies on the duality of it is and it is not. But one who sees the arising of the world as it happens with complete understanding has no sense of it is not about the world. And one who sees the ceasing of the world as it happens with complete understanding has no sense of it is about the world. So this movement of the mind, basic movement of the mind, it is and it is not. It's the ground of our dualistic perception, which is the sense of separateness. things are separate. And so when he's looking into this dynamic, you know, he talked about the five heaps, the five skandhas: form, feelings, perceptions, impulses, consciousness. That's basic, that's the human organism, right? That was his focus. He says, bhikkhu, when he looked into this, he says, bhikkhus, the body, or rupa, is not self. If it were, it would not get sick. You could tell your body, be like this or don't be like that. You ever tell your body that? He points out, but because the body is not self, it does get sick. You can't tell it, be like this, don't be like that. Stephen Batchelor, in his book After Buddhism, goes on to point out that that somehow got into our heads about there being no self. But the Buddha didn't say that there was a self or no self. He refused to answer that question when asked. So maybe we can think of this something called self as something that's contingently configured based, you know, arising from causes and conditions. Dogen didn't shy away from the word self. He said to carry the self forward is delusion. And echoing the Buddha 1700 years later, I think, if my math is right, he said, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. So I'm here to encourage you all in the study of self. As boring, as meh as that might sound, it's worth it. Practice gets richer, it gets livelier, it gets more interesting. And it's interesting too that as someone observed during the Sesshin we just had, this guy saw this stuff 2,500 years, now science is catching up to it. In his book, The Developing Mind, Dan Siegel actually speaks directly to this. Siegel defines mind as not just the brain. It's all the neural pathways that extend down through the autonomic nervous system and on into the body. If I remember correctly, he said there's something like 2 million miles of that in each one of us. I stand to be corrected, but I think that's what he said. And he says that when we think about conditioning, he says, from the moment of conception, that starts with the development of the neural pathways in the brain and the body. It's ongoing. It's ongoing. It's by every bit of experience creates and shapes neural pathways. And in relationship. Relationship, fundamentally, that's what's happening, how we are with each other. And the Buddha's fourth noble truth was very much about that, in relationship. right speech, right thought, right action, right livelihood. It was all in community. So when you think about this, and then this passage from Siegel, which captures really well when the Buddha talked about the moment of contact, and he talked about the 12 links of dependent arising, about that moment of contact. So that moment of contact, all this conditionality arising at the moment of contact, arising into the experience and shaping and coloring the experience. When one of us speaks to another, Siegel says, the voice box stimulates the movement of air molecules manifested as kinetic energy. The eardrum responds to this energy flow by creating electrochemical energy movement within the acoustic nerve and downstream neural circuits of the brain. Ions flow in and out of the neural membranes, and the release of chemical transmitters activates downstream neurons. When these patterns of neural firing match with prior learning, then this energy flow has informational value, and the listener can understand what the speaker has said. But we can also appreciate in this that how the listener hears what's being said and how that's been shaped by what's come before, right? The same thing with as the speaker that the listener is hearing, that person's conditioning in the pattern of what that person is trying to convey and in that sense of energy flow between the two of them. And there is energy flow. When you read this, there's energy flow. One pattern of energy is activating another pattern of energy. There's energy flow there. Twenty-five hundred years later, Siegel says, one implication is that we don't own our minds. That we, our individual selves, are interdependent on others for the functioning of our minds. So this then begs the question about this thing called self. Where does it end? Is there a sharp demarcation, line of demarcation about self? Or is this interflow here? Self. Little self, big self. So in my therapy training, I tend towards the somatic. What's coming up? How are you experiencing this physically? Can you be with that? And then I translate this to the client. Can you be with that? I translate this to my students. Can you turn into the hard stuff? Can you be with it? Can you see what it has to teach us right now? This is here. What can we learn from it? Turning into it. Getting more and more intimate with this something called self. One time the Buddha was asked for a very quick version of the way to awakening. And this is how he responded. This is how you should train, Bahia. In what is seen, let there be just the seen. In what is heard, let there be just the heard. In what is sensed, let there be just the sensed. in what is cognized, let there be just the cognized, then you will not be in that. When you are not in that, there is no you there. When there is no you there, then you are neither here nor there nor in between. This, just this, is the end of suffering. So no you in there. So how do we work with that? How do we practice with that? I use the word selfing. You know, noticing when we're carrying the self forward, as Dogen says. When we take up the room, when it's all about me, the self-centeredness. And selfing also includes when we're pushing elements of self away. The psyche has a hard time. It resists when we try to pull back the curtains and see what's really going on. That's just a natural thing. Please excuse the laptop. So some years ago, I discovered this Vipassana teacher. His name is Tahani, or Tajani. He's in Myanmar. And every day, one of his students, Doug McGill, sends out something from him. So, again, this is for the encouragement of the study of self. And you think, well, this is just so hard. I don't know how to do this. Our conditioned and habitual view of our world is that the process of mind and matter is me. I am looking at me. I know me. But we can't meditate to develop wisdom using that point of view. If we think of the body or mind as me, then craving, aversion, and confusion will arise. So thinking of something as me, giving rise to craving and aversion, which just reifies the sense of self and that sense of separation. If we think we are having a good experience, we will start attaching to it or trying to create more of it, which is craving. If we think we are having a bad experience, we will start denying it, avoiding it, or pushing it away, which is aversion. If the mind is spaced out and missing everything, or it is busy rationalizing and defending our cravings and aversion, that is confusion. When we look clearly at what is by practicing awareness with the right view, wisdom begins to rise. This begins to give us a clear picture of the way things are, which is the nature of reality towards which the Buddha pointed. This is how to develop right view. Right view is the understanding that the mind is nature, not an I or me. The mind is not self. It is not personal. It's not me, it's not mine, no one is there. This is right view, and we practice to discover this nature. The moment we get a real answer to a question asked in meditation, when the mind really sees something, it lets go. The mind needs to be directed. And right interest, Dhamma Vachaya, does that. We'll go further into that from him in a little bit. Once you have set a direction for the mind, it will continue in that direction. And I think there is something to that, because when I think, in my experience, you begin to sense, when you're present with something, you're present with activation, and it could be, or just that sense of selfing, and you turn into it somatically, and you're just with it, and you begin to, then you may very quickly just feel a shift out of it. And you feel that in your body, your heart begins to open. And the more that happens, this sense, this something that we call concentration, you feel it begin to build over time. You feel more grounded. The ballast of your boat is deeper. And I'm having an old guy moment here. Look up to me. But it's a, it gets, oh. And is that, I'm convinced that, it came, that this is the rewiring that's happening. And as that rewiring happens, that Siegel talks about, at a certain point, it sort of reaches a critical mass, if you will, a tipping point. And it takes on its own momentum. Once you have set a direction for the mind, it will continue in that direction. This is a natural quality of the mind. If you leave the mind undirected, there will be chaos. Never be satisfied with what you have understood. The moment we feel satisfied with ourselves, we lessen our efforts. It's about being steady, so keep going steadily. The Buddha said the energy of right effort is ardent and resolute. Try to bring forth these qualities while remaining completely relaxed, steady, and calm. Remaining relaxed, steady, and calm. That's right effort. There is no need to make objects disappear. By objects, it means thoughts of the mind, sensations of the body, perceptions of the world, emotions, moods, etc. Stuff arising up here, right? There's no need to make objects disappear, and it is irrelevant whether they disappear or not. There's no you there. There's nothing to catch on the Velcro, right? You are observing because you want to know and understand the nature of all phenomena. This curiosity. The mind becomes more curious. This is right view and right attitude. When I say do the work, what I really mean is simply step back. Sort of Dogen's learning to take the step backward that shines the light inward. To step back and allow the mind to do its own work, which is meditate. This is what the mind does. This is its nature. When the mind is relaxed and spacious, it becomes easier to observe thoughts, sensations, perceptions, emotions, and other objects of mind. I think we need to appreciate something here when we read that, and it doesn't come automatically to us. This conditioned nature and what's happened to us in life and what continues to happen to us in life. A lot of people experience trauma in life. A lot of people live very ongoing, stressful, hectic lives, which keeps that autonomic nervous system ramped up, keeps the cortisol and adrenaline levels up there. So, the practice, sitting over time, being patient with oneself, being with the activation in the body, turning into it, it begins to ease, and more that happens, it begins to happen more easily. So be patient with yourself. This is, you know, we're all different. So, and our conditioning is all different, arising to meet this. The mind does its own work through recognizing, being aware, knowing, thinking about the practice and being interested. If you identify with this process, it becomes very complicated. But if you just recognize that the mind is doing these things and making certain choices, it is easy to observe and investigate how the mind works. When the mind becomes balanced, understanding arises naturally. I am not meditating, but meditation is happening. Suzuki Roshi said, you don't set zazen, zazen sets zazen. At that time, the understanding becomes deeper. We're just seeing and acknowledging what is already happening. And so, Tijaniya gives a very clear example from his own experience. How am I doing on time?
It's 11:12.
It's what?
11:12.
Okay. Once I was sitting in meditation while listening to my teacher, Shui Wuming Saidaw, give a Dhamma talk. My mind was very calm, but suddenly I saw it become highly agitated. How did this happen? How did anger arise in the mind so quickly when it was perfectly peaceful only moments before? In that moment, I noticed something very interesting. My mind became curious about what had happened. It wanted to know about itself. It wanted to know why it had lost its peacefulness and had become angry. So it backed up a bit and it began to ask questions. Its interest in knowing itself then changed the mind's quality away from anger, As I continued to sit, I was able to watch aversion operating in the mind. On the one hand, the mind was straining to hear what my teacher was saying. On the other, a group of children were making noise just outside the meditation hall. Do you think we can get that happening around here, children making noise outside the zendo? I wanted them to stop, and I saw the mind complaining about the noise and complaining that I couldn't hear my teacher's talk. Some strong feelings came up. The observing mind saw everything that was going on in the mind. Can you see how this expansive mind's field of view was at this point? After it saw itself going back and forth, picking and choosing, as we read in our sutra this morning, Shinshin Ming. Going back and forth between these two sides for a while, it saw the dissatisfaction, the aversion. The mind realized that it had taken one kind of sound, which was the sound of my teacher's voice, and labeled it good and favorable, whereas the sounds of other people's talking were bad, unwanted sounds. In this moment of realization, the mind didn't favor one object or another. It was able to hear sounds just as sounds without buying into the story that the mind was telling about good sounds, bad sounds. When there is sound, just let there be the sound. No you there. At that point, the mind stopped both its craving to hear my teacher's voice and its aversion to hear the voices of the people who were talking. Instead, the mind just remained in the middle and continued watching with interest. The mind saw the suffering and just died down. When I read that, I hear Dogen. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. So this forgetting the self is not something that we will to happen. If we're trying to do that, we're getting in the way of it. So we see this curiosity, this awakeness, being with, and just seeing the causes and conditions of play. Our perspective changes. The mind's, the small mind perspective changes from me to when I'm not in there, and it gets bigger, right? And things become quiet. The Buddha called this quality of inquiry in the mind Dhamma Vicaya, which means a mind that naturally investigates reality. It is a mind that studies itself by asking questions to discover what is happening and why it is happening. The mind wants to know the nature of the three wholesome, unwholesome root quality, greed, hate, aversion. As I said earlier, if you choose to study the mind, the practice gets really rich. Life gets richer. It gets richer because we're unhooking from this narrow perspective based on me. And the system, the somatic awareness, the system, you begin to feel life, the energy of life, actually. And it's not all going to be pleasant, according to little mind. It's not always going to be pleasant. You'll feel things a little bit more acutely, a little bit more jarringly. But then you're better able to come back upright and rest in ease. This is the end of craving. The end of suffering. And then we go around another round. But at least we've interrupted one round of the samsaric cycle, right? The cycle of suffering. We're interrupting the wiring, old patterns. And then we're seeing what happens. It's real. I mean, it's real. It's just not some hypothetical something. Excuse me if I get a little excited. So thank you for listening to me today. Are there any questions? And please, I got my hearing aids turned up, but please speak up a little bit more distinctly, if you could, please.
Hi, Hokio. May I embarrass myself one last time before you go back to Illinois and share? Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. Can you hear me? I just want to share a little experience I had during this session, which relates to exactly what you were just describing, that, you know, especially for newcomers, what it is we are doing here and why we are doing it. And this was my first week-long session, and I didn't know what to expect. And as people who were there and you remember, I always, during the Dharma talk and also the dialogue, I always promised myself not to say anything, but just couldn't help it. I had to open my mouth and say something, and afterwards feel foolish. So in one of those moments, if you recall, I was asking the group there that, hey, open up and spill your guts. There might be a lot of junk in there, but there are some precious pearls and gemstones. They might be tarnished or tarred, but you will find them. And one of those things happened to me was that one morning, I believe it was in the same day, that earlier morning, you helped me actually to find one of those gemstones and polish it a little bit. And what happened was I was standing outside the Zendo. You came out and walked directly to me, gave me a little hug, and said, "You enjoyed sitting Zazen with me." Later during the Zazen, I realized the impact of that seemingly little encounter. I was really choked up with tears and couldn't stop myself. And it made me think that I might be on the right path. And it meant a lot to me. And I'm very grateful to you. And I just have to make sure that this doesn't get into my head. And, you know, this is just the beginning of the whole journey. And there are more gems to be found and be polished. So that's all I wanted to share from this experience that I had. And I hope I didn't make another fool of myself again. And by the way, I coined or recoined a phrase there that whatever happens at Jokoji stays at Jokoji. So open up and spill your guts. And it's copyrighted, huh?
Thank you. Thank you, Akbar. I see a hand up. Yeah.
Thanks for your talk today. During meditation, I was actually thinking something related that you mentioned, and I wanted to ask. So, maybe when life is a little stressful, it's like harder to get into the calm, mindful state in meditation, and maybe even harder to like start meditating in the first place. And then you said something kind of counterintuitive, which is that like noticing maybe something you're dealing with will help you to be more calm. How in the moment do you avoid getting like stuck ruminating about something though? Like about kind of, like if you're gonna think about it, getting stuck into like a, going down that path of continuing to think about it.
Yeah. You turn into it. So, you, and I say turn into it, in your sitting practice is what I encourage is that just when you're sitting, nothing difficult is happening or any resistance, right? And so when there's thinking, notice what the thinking feels like. There's an energy to it, okay? You might feel it up here in the head, in the body, and that's where you turn your attention. And so what you've done is you stepped outside the narrative, down in under it, but you're still with the energy of it, so you haven't pushed anything aside. And very often what happens then, just in the normal course of what's going on in the mind, it'll fall away. It just happens. And then again you feel that shift. The Buddha said, notice when it's like this, and notice when it's like that. And that's important. Rick Hansen, a neuroscientist and insight meditation teacher, says that we are wired to notice the negative and not over the positive. And so, for instance, when there's the positive, we want to spend time with it to seal it in, to seal the experience in. That's part of the rewiring, right? This is the same thing. When we feel the release from activation, even if it's slight, that's got a grip on you, you do the same thing. And it may be like riding a wild horse. It may be like you're swept away by a tsunami. I've experienced all of the above. And you stay in, but you keep coming back to the energy of it in the being. And you keep riding it. You keep riding it. You may have to tell yourself in the midst of all this, this is just a conditioned something. And that's all it is. It's just a conditioned pattern that's coming through. You know, and so when we interrupt, you know, when we step in under the cycle, we step in under the thinking. That thinking is what perpetuates emotions. They're chemical reactions of the body. With left to their own devices, will flow through the body in about 90 seconds. But it's the thinking that keeps it going. And then, you know, somebody asked during the session, which comes first, thinking or emotions or thinking? It's it both. Right? But you become really alive to the patterns. Okay? And pretty soon when you'll catch yourself in something, and you go, oh, yeah. And you just come back into it. And the mind clears. And then, as the mind clears, the being's clear, then you're able to see things more clearly and respond from a different spot. And Siegel talks about the emergent mind. When our conditioned patterns fall away, the conditioned way we respond, and all that falls away, then what? There's this openness to, all right, being alive to what's alive in the causes and conditions. Being alive and able to respond from a different place. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. That's helpful.
Thank you. Yes, Cheryl.
Just to add a little bit to this conversation. Mm-hmm. Just to add a little bit to this conversation. I remember hearing from another teacher kind of interesting statement. He said, it's only a meditator that knows when he's not meditating. Mm-hmm. And when a meditator knows when he's not meditating, he's meditating. Because he's actually mindful that he's in a state of non-meditation. And that is a state of awareness. That's a state of recognition of a mental state. Yeah. So when you recognize that you're not meditating, you actually are meditating upon non-meditating, you can say.
Yeah.
It's kind of a funny statement, but I enjoyed it hearing it.
That's not, it's true. It's true. Thank you. Interestingly enough, in the developing mind, you know what Siegel ends up talking about is a way to work with ourselves? Mindfulness. It's this awareness. This awareness. It's changing neural pathways. In community, in relationship, changing neural pathways. So we get really sensitive to our energy patterns, what might be happening with somebody else, what the impact might be on somebody else, and conversely, their energy patterns and experiencing them. And then we also notice that when we're making them a you, and what happens with that. Yes.
So this is a question related to the suffering. So for example, you are working with a team and there is like a, I'm just giving an example, so there is a competition and you are in part of a team.
Remember what says what happens at Jikoji, stays at Jikoji, so you're okay.
Okay. And then you really want to win in the competition, but your teammates are not as enthusiastic and you lose the competition, and you have in deep inside the suffering that you created, and the blame that you are blaming to the teammate who didn't want it or didn't do enough to win the competition. How do you forgive them and not create suffering for yourself, and to be equanimity, like just taking part in a competition is also a win.
A learning
like
experience.
That.
Yeah. I'm very cautious with that word forgive. Okay. So when we're noticing, we're with what's arising, as you said, the suffering that's arising, you know, rising from the causes and conditions, no patterns coming up. And then the thought and the projection And so there's a projection happening there onto the other person. You cause this. And so then you want to turn into that dynamic. Where is that projection arising from in you? Okay? And be with it. And you know, so you can simply ask yourself, where is this coming from? You've entered, for one thing, you've turned the light back in. So you've interrupted the projection again. And then it's working with that the energy that the projection is coming from. That's the root of it. So aversion, clinging, aversion to losing, clinging to the idea of winning, and what storyline about you has been threatened because of the losing. Right? So you begin to investigate it in a way like that. And then you see what happens. At least the projection out onto the other has stopped, that pattern. And that's a fundamental thing we have, especially if we don't deal with our stuff that's in the closet, behind the curtain, because it's always being projected out. You've interrupted that. Okay? And so when these patterns have been interrupted, then you see what's there for you. That doesn't mean you stop wanting to win, you stop wanting to compete. But these internal processes have been interrupted for you.
So my understanding is just look inside to understand where the projection and projecting towards the other member of the team that will.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
My wife appreciates when I do that. Okay. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.